Part 1, The Pre-Flagler Era. Chapter 1, Blacks in Early South Florida, 1646 to 1895. From the infamous pirate Black Caesar's arrival in Biscayne Bay, probably in the 1600s, to the comings of the Stirrups and Dorseys centuries later, Blacks have had an influence on South Florida history and development. With the settlement of the Bahama Islands in the late 18th century, Blacks were but a day's sailing away from the crystal blue waters of Biscayne Bay. Farm workers from the Bahamas were moving up the Florida Keys in considerable numbers by the mid-1900s, as the economy of the Bahamas collapsed. During this time, before the birth of Miami, Blacks and Seminole Indians in Florida formed an alliance that lasted nearly a century. In 1804, the first Black slaves were brought to Key Biscayne. Later, others were brought to plantations built on the site of present-day downtown Miami. In post-Civil War Dade County, Black settlements sprang up in Lemon City, a few miles north of what would become Miami, and in Coconut Grove to the south. All of this before the arrival of the railroad and the founding of Miami in 1896. Black pirates on Biscayne Bay. The first Black presence on Biscayne Bay was probably a pirate. According to the legend, before the establishment of Miami, Coconut Grove, or Lemon City, indeed, over a century before the Cape Florida Lighthouse was built on Key Biscayne in 1825, a Black pirate called Black Caesar took a toll on ships sailing off the Great Florida Reef near present-day Miami. His presence on the bay is mired in tales of violence, enforced prostitution, ingenious feats of seamanship, and still undiscovered treasure beneath the white sands of South Florida. There are several conflicting accounts of Black Caesar and his murderous henchmen, leading to the conclusion that there were probably two Black Caesars with more than a century separating their exploits. The tales that persist may be more myth than truth. According to one version, in the late 17th century, a ship laden with hundreds of slaves was fatally driven against the Great Florida Reef. A giant Black man, having reached dry land alive and alone, set himself adrift in the Gulf Stream in a tiny boat that had washed ashore. A sloop spotted the small craft and rescued the exhausted traveler. Once aboard, however, the huge slave attacked the captain and disposed of the crew members who refused to join him. In the next few years, he brazenly parlayed this sloop into larger craft and became known as Black Caesar. His lair was Elliott Key, the first large island south of Key Biscayne. A channel there bears the name Caesar's Creek. The area around Cape Florida was ideal for Black Caesar. The Florida Straits provided an unending parade of prizes, and when necessary, the bay granted a magnificent avenue of escape. Biscayne Bay's tricky mud flats and shoals were deadly to the uninitiated, and beyond the bay were mangroves and blind-mouth channels known only to Caesar. On those rare occasions when he was closely pursued, Caesar headed for the maze of mangrove channels where condominiums stand today. He would quickly disappear in the marshy swamp, dismast his vessel, and sink it in shallow water. With his ship thus underwater and his men hidden, Caesar could vanish from the most determined enemy. Another tactic Black Caesar favored was the use of a metal ring embedded deeply in a rock on a particular small island, probably near Caesar's Creek. With a sturdy line through the ring, Caesar could heel his ship, tilt the vessel onto its side, and hide its mast from passing vessels. When a prize came within striking distance, a lookout signal, the ship was quickly righted, and Caesar found himself on the forecastle of his startled prey. According to Florida historian Jim Woodman, as Black Caesar became infamous throughout the region, fantastic tales were told of him. These old yarns form the current legends. Most versions agree that Black Caesar was exceptionally cruel and that he had a lust for jewels along with a passion for luxury. One report claims that at one time he held more than 100 white women captive at a prison camp on Elliott Key. He incarcerated his prisoners in stone huts, leaving them to starve when he abandoned the camp. Reportedly, a few small children escaped the death camp and survived to wander about the Key, subsisting on berries and shellfish, and in time developing a primitive language of their own. This may account for the Seminole legend that the Key was haunted. In the early 1700s, Black Caesar left Biscayne Bay to join the arch pirate Captain Edward Teach, alias Blackbeard, who was operating from the west coast of Florida near Tampa. Black Caesar became Blackbeard's trusted lieutenant. Together in the 40-gun Queen Anne's Revenge, they plagued the American coast. Their partnership ended abruptly when the British Navy killed Teach off the coast of North Carolina in 1718. Black Caesar was reportedly captured, taken to Virginia for trial, and hanged the same year in Williamsburg. Nearly a century after the death of the first Black Caesar, there were reports of another black pirate operating in the Biscayne Bay area. This pirate was an American-born slave who had an African mother and a Scottish father. He learned the local channels and was attacking ships in the Florida Straits in the early 1800s. The second black pirate soon adopted his predecessor's name, also becoming known as Black Caesar. The new Black Caesar ventured far into the Caribbean. He was said to have captured a treasure ship 800 miles east of Cuba, carrying 26 tons of silver. The pirate sailed the galleon to Biscayne Bay, where it is believed he unloaded his prize. What he did with his mountainous fortune remains a mystery. By 1828, this Black Caesar had become such a nuisance to shipping that President Andrew Jackson's new administration organized a naval expedition to end the Buccaneers' Biscayne Bay operations. Black Caesar temporarily looted the Navy and, like his predecessor, escaped to the Florida West Coast, where he met his death. There are two versions of what happened. Some say he was killed by a woman while boarding a vessel in the Gulf of Mexico. A second version asserts that he was finally captured by the Navy and taken to Key West, where he was tied to a tree and burned to death. The fatal fire was said to have been set by the widow of a Baltimore preacher whose eyes Caesar had burned out. Did either Black Caesar actually exist? Most Miami historians leave the question open, but there's evidence that pirates may have operated in Biscayne Bay prior to the arrival of English-speaking whites. According to Woodman, quote, in the early 1900s, before a concrete breakwater protected Cape Florida, the seas washed away the shoreline and uncovered ancient arms, pirate barshot, and a skeleton in a crude cypress coffin. Gold coins have been found on Virginia and Elliott Keys. A captain's chest and silver coins have been uncovered in mangroves near Cutler Ridge, unquote. Coconut Grove pioneer Commodore Ralph Monroe arrived at the foot of Biscayne Bay by way of Caesar's Creek in 1877. An acknowledgement that pirates operated on Biscayne Bay long before his arrival is contained in his memoirs. Quote, we entered Biscayne Bay through Caesar's Creek, a long and winding channel running first through a submerged bank 3 miles wide, then between a number of beautifully wooded islands, and finally branching into several entrances to the foot of the bay. Here we were again invested with the spirit of piracy, for this was the stronghold of Black Caesar, a giant Negro who took toll from passing vessels along the reef. Caesar's Rock, a small island about middle of the creek, was reputed to be the dwelling place and shipyard of the pirate. It was afterwards brought by my friends, the Hines, and we explored it many times, looking for buried treasure, but finding nothing more than rusty iron, unquote. Blacks on Early Key Biscayne, 1804 to 1893. The first sustained presence of blacks in what is now Dade County dates back to 1804, at which time Florida was still under Spanish control. The Spanish government was awarding tracts of land to Spaniards, particularly those living in St. Augustine, to settle on an island on the lower east coast of Florida, which they called Key Biscayne. 100 acres were granted for each head of household, 50 for each child, and 25 for each slave. In 1790, less than a decade after the American Revolution, a Spaniard named Pedro Fornells applied for a tract containing 175 acres on uninhabited Key Biscayne. In 1804, Fornells left St. Augustine in a newly purchased schooner to settle the island. He was accompanied by his family, two Spanish companions, and several slaves. With his slaves, Fornells brought his tract of land on Key Biscayne under cultivation, but his involvement in the venture was short-lived. Being far from the protection of Spanish guns at St. Augustine, he faced raids by marauding English and French ships. In 1805, Fornells returned to St. Augustine, where he soon died. However, in his departure, he left behind some of his slaves, who escaped into the nearby swamp. One of Fornells' companions, a man known only as Vincent, also stayed on the island with some of the slaves and successfully grew crops of guinea corn and coffee. In his book about the early settlement of the island, Jim Goodwin documents that Fornells' slaves remained there for several seasons, However, their ultimate fate is a mystery. The slaves left behind by Fornells and Vincent may have been the first blacks to settle permanently in what is now Dade County. Woodman observes that after the failure of the Fornells venture, quote, there were no white settlers in the next few years. Instead, hundreds of Indians and Negroes swarmed over the island, unquote. In the 20 years between the departure of the Fornells and the building of the Cape Florida Lighthouse in 1825, Key Biscayne was frequented by gulls, sea turtles, Indians, and escaped slaves from Georgia and other southern states. Cape Florida, at the tip of Key Biscayne, was the departure point for runaways en route to the Bahamas and freedom. It was a well-chosen point. Key Biscayne stands nearer to the world's mightiest ocean current, the Gulf Stream, than any other piece of land. Andros Island and several other Bahama islands were ultimately settled by escaped slaves from the United States who launched their trip to freedom from Key Biscayne long before English-speaking people settled the island. According to Woodman, in 1821, more than 100 slaves and Indians were left on the island in search of subsistence. Quote, these hunted black Indians could feel the slave catchers' footsteps nearby as they waited for boats to take them across the straits to the Bahamas, unquote. Spain ceded Florida to the United States in 1821. Mary Ann Davis, the wife of the U.S. Marshal in St. Augustine, purchased the Fornells tract from Pedro Fornell's son, who was living in St. Augustine, with his widowed mother. The Davis family moved to Key Biscayne in the early 1820s. When Davis learned that the federal government was interested in building a lighthouse on the island, he deeded the government 3 acres at the southernmost tip. The lighthouse was built in 1825 using English bricks brought in by sea by its Boston builder. The first lighthouse keeper, John DeBose, arrived on May 7, 1825, to assume his duties. In the 1830s, the lighthouse served mainland white settlers as a refuge from Indian attacks during the Third Seminole Indian War. One of the most dramatic events to occur on Key Biscayne took place in July of 1836. It involved lighthouse keeper J.B. Thompson, a slave named Aaron Carter, and dozens of hostile Indians who held the lighthouse under siege. Thompson and Carter defended the lighthouse for several days as they waited for help to arrive. Carter was killed in the fierce fighting and was buried on the island near the lighthouse. According to Joan Gill Blank, quote, when they brought down Carter's body, they dug a grave and buried him beside the lighthouse, the only person ever killed in defense of a U.S. lighthouse attacked by Indians. If Aaron Carter was a slave, he was free at last, unquote. As a result of the Indian attacks on Key Biscayne, in 1838, the military established a small fort on the key called Fort Bankhead. It became the major staging area for the United States troops engaged in Indian warfare in South Florida. In addition to the federal personnel on the island, a few white civilian settlers were attracted to the key, and the town of Key Biscayne was platted in 1838. Later, the Army moved its operations to the north side of the Miami River. There they established Fort Dallas. The migration of Bahamian blacks to the Florida Keys, 1646 to 1896. In 1646, an Englishman, Captain William Saley, reported that the British government had granted him one of the Bahamian Islands. Although no record of such a claim has ever been found, it is known that a company called the Eleutheran Adventurers was founded in London in that year for the purpose of establishing a colony in the New World. Saley led a group of English settlers to the Bahama Island that Columbus had named Sagato. He changed the name to Eleuthera. Perhaps no colony has ever been established with a broader or more archaic concept of freedom. The whites who were attracted to the colony at Eleuthera were different from other settlers arriving in the New World. Most wanted more religious freedom than was granted in England at the time. Among them were religious zealots and later revolutionaries seeking refuge who contributed to the laissez-faire propensities of the colonists. Most of the adventurers were Cockney fisher folk. Once ensconced in the Bahamas, their fishing and turtling expeditions carried them to the islands of the West Indies and along the Florida coast and Keys. They sold their catches in Key West and in Havana. These people became known as conchs, named after a shellfish found abundantly in the Caribbean and Florida Keys and eaten heartily by these seafaring people. Some of the conchs migrated from the Bahama Islands to Key West and up the Florida Keys. Many of the blacks on Eleuthera were runaway slaves from West Indian plantations. Others were dropped there after British sailors liberated slave ships on the high seas when England abolished slavery in 1807. The descendants of these former slaves moved through the Florida Keys with the Conks in their various enterprises. Consequently, many black Bahamians became accomplished at fishing and sailing the waters off the Florida coast. In addition to fishing, the island's economy and lifestyle were built around wrecking. Whenever there was a shipwreck, white and black wreckers would drop what they were doing and head for the site. Whatever they salvaged, they could either sell or use themselves. Many of the black Bahamian men worked on steamers, and some were even ship captains. The abundant cedar and other fine woods on the banks of many of the islands drew other black Bahamian families into shipbuilding. There were also good jobs to be had in agriculture, sponging and turtling. Turtling provided food as well as income. Bahamians cultivated pineapples, limes, and sarsaparillas, which they called sours and dillies. The fragrant half-mile Mexican limes grown on the islands were in demand as a scurvy preventive on sailing vessels, which accounts for the name lime juices being given to ships from the Bahamas. Some of the Conks and blacks drifted to the Florida Keys to grow pineapples, which turned out to be a remarkable commercial venture. They cut down the virgin mahogany and dogwood forests of the Upper Keys to plant large tracts of pineapples. By the late 1890s, these plantations had attracted a considerable number of Bahamian blacks as laborers. The main fields on Elliott Key and Key Largo were soon producing firm, juicy pineapples of superior flavor, which were transported to New York, Baltimore, and Boston markets on Conk-owned fleets. Excitement ran high when the pineapple fleet prepared to sail. Black workers, balancing huge baskets of pineapples on their heads, loaded the waiting ships. The sloops then sailed north past Cape Florida, racing one another as well as the ripening fruit. A perfectly timed arrival was highly lucrative, but a late one meant a worthless cargo of spoiled pineapples. By 1875, the Upper Keys annually shipped 1 million crates to northern markets. Blacks made up the bulk of the labor force in this lucrative industry as more and more migrated from the Bahamas to the Florida Keys. Then suddenly it all ended. The pineapples stopped growing and the young plants turned brown. The Conks called it the brown wilt. Actually, the thin layer of rich soil, a product of centuries of decomposing tropical vegetation, had finally given out. As the 19th century drew to a close, black workers in the Florida Keys were looking north for new jobs. A book written in 1889 gives a clear image of black Bahamian family life at the close of the 19th century. L.D. Pools was a circuit justice from England who traveled to many of the small Bahamian islands, keeping a journal of daily Bahamian life as he saw it. By his account, meat was imported from the United States, as were peaches, apples, and pears. Bananas, watermelon, potatoes, and onions were abundant. Fish, grits, sugarcane, and oranges were also plentiful and became an essential part of the Bahamian diet. In spite of the abundance of food, according to Pools, many black Bahamian families were near starvation as the economy of the country collapsed. Many blacks felt the urge to leave the Bahamas due to the racial discrimination and economic exploitation they experienced in the islands. The so-called truck system of farming, similar to sharecropping in the United States following the Civil War in the South, sucked the economic life out of black families who were paid with such goods as flour or other commodities rather than with cash. The desire for cash led many Bahamians to Key West, where work was rewarded with money. The economic and social deprivation that blacks suffered in the Bahamas sent many of them to the Florida Keys. Very little has been written about the ethnic background and history of these early black immigrants to the Keys, but it is believed that black wreckers from the Bahamas and Key West visited the Biscayne Bay area even before the tip of the Florida Peninsula was settled by the first white English-speaking families. As white farmers began to trickle down to the wilderness on Biscayne Bay in the 1870s, black Bahamians seeking to escape the economic decline of the Bahamas migrated seasonally to South Florida to find farm work. By the time the city of Miami was founded, there was a growing Bahamian population permanently settled in various parts of Dade County. There were Bahamian enclaves in Lemon City, Coconut Grove, and Cutler in far south Dade County. When Miami was established in 1896, more than 40% of the black population was Bahamian. The Bahamians brought their African-derived customs and traditions to South Florida. The most notable among them that survived today in present-day Miami were the Junkanoo and the Goombay celebrations. The Junkanoo is a street festival of African derivation which probably emerged first in Jamaica. It was celebrated around Christmas in the Caribbean and in Miami's Black Coconut Grove community. The most elaborate 18th century description of the Jamaican festival may be found in the narrative of Edward Long, an English planter, politician, and author of The History of Jamaica, published in 1774. Long's history documents elaborate street performances, which he undoubtedly observed during his residence on the islands in the 1750s and 1760s. These street performances included masked characters performing in mime, as well as troops of players acting out scenes from English theatrical plays. Other chronicles of the time also refer to black dancers wearing strange face masks and horned headdresses. Contemporary descriptions, especially Long's, strongly suggest two separate groups performing independently and representing two different traditions of art and theater. One of these traditions was distinctly African, and the other was derived from English folk theater. Long not only describes the performers and their costumes, especially the cowtails and cow horns and swords, but also notes the principal dancer wore a visor-type mask with a mouth section supported by boar tusks. He called this central character Junkanoo. According to one account of the origin of the Junkanoo, both the parade and the main character are honorable memorials to John Coney, a successful black merchant near Axum on the Guinea coast around 1720. According to Basil Smith and Gene Tenney, experts on the Bahamian influence in Miami, quote, Junkanoo was first celebrated centuries ago by Africans brought to the New World as slaves. Originally known as Junkanoo or Junkanooe, the festival's name is believed to be the anglicized form of Janin Kanoe. The name is said to be a combination of the West African Kuja tribe's deity Kano and the dead or Jani, who were regarded as patrons of the tribe, unquote. The other big annual celebration in the black section of Coconut Grove is the Goombay Festival, also a tradition now rooted in South Florida. It is also observed in Bermuda, where the Christmas dances and their celebration are known as Goombay. These gaily costumed street dancers have performed since at least the early 1800s, although the style of their costumes and the festival's formal structure have changed considerably. In an account of the event from 1829, the celebration was observed near Christmas and was performed on the lawn of an estate in Bermuda. The participants were described as singing special songs and covering their clothing with scarlet cloth decorated with colored ribbons. Some of the dancers used paint on their bodies. The musicians wore neat white uniforms with scarlet facings. 19th century documentation of the festival's form and costumes is sketchy, as individual groups of black Bermudans staged local performances in their own distinct manner. One element, however, seems to have been consistent among the various performances: the use of a particular headdress, a house worn on the head. Theodore Gadet reports a Christmas parade where participants sang songs of ridicule and derision. The chief instrument was a small barrel drum called a gumbi. The participants wore masks, fantastic costumes, and a chateau or castle on their heads. Quote, the Goombay parade is usually held on Christmas Eve between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m. Perhaps it has been transferred to the holiday season because greater leisure is enjoyed and it is a time of general merrymaking. At this time, groups of men and boys, women seldom participate, parade around the country, going from house to house, singing, dancing, and playing on crude instruments. Among them, the triangle, the tambourine are prominent, penny whistles and cantinas also being called to their aid. The men wear their ordinary garments, but a mask bearing on their heads the heads and horns of hideous-looking beasts, formidable only to the uncultured mind, as well as beautifully made imitations of houses and ships, both lighted by candles, unquote. According to Smith and Tenney, the name, quote, Goombay, unquote, refers to the indigenous music of the Bahamas. The compulsive, percussive rhythm of its music and the witty, often satirical lyrics played an important role in the day-to-day lives of the island communities. Although knowledge of the actual origin of the word is vague, it is believed by some to have its origin in the West African dialect spoken by the slaves who were brought to the Bahamas over 300 years ago. Others believe the word is a verbal rendition of the sound made when a goatskin drum of the type used in the music is struck first in the center and then at the edge. The technique results in a sound like gumba, which has come to be pronounced Goombay over the years. Smith and Tenney assert that whatever the origin of the term may be, it is a fact that the music is a unique product of the meeting of African and European cultures in the New World. In their view, Gumbe developed from the same musical pulse which surfaced in Haiti as the merengue, in Jamaica as the mento, and in Trinidad as the calypso. In the Black Coconut Grove community, the Gumbe celebration is held annually in June. The event is attended by tens of thousands of people from various ethnic groups, although most celebrants are Black. Traditionally, a band from the Bahamas is brought over to perform for the event. The festival is known for its wide offerings of Bahamian, Caribbean, and Black American dishes from vendors who line the streets. Rebecca Gibson Johnson, born in Coconut Grove in 1903, gave this description of the event in the early 1900s. Quote, "The first Gumbe festival I remember was held at the Oddfellows Hall a long time ago, before I was old enough to take part. Everybody would join in, looking to have a good time." Unquote. The Alliance of Blacks and Seminoles, 1750 to 1840. In the early 1800s, it was the policy of the new American government, having won its own freedom, to remove all Native Americans from east of the Mississippi River to the territory that later would become the states of Arkansas and Oklahoma. The Union government used the Indian Removal Act to clear the way for white settlement of Indian lands in eastern and southern portions of the United States. The act was signed in 1830 by President Andrew Jackson. The Lower Creeks occupied land adjacent to Spanish Florida in what later would become Georgia and Alabama. They and the powerful Cherokee Nation were the largest of the southeastern tribes. In 1750, Chief Sacoffey and some of his followers broke away from the Creeks. These Indians became known as Seminoles or Runaways. The belligerent Seminoles resented the attempts to remove them to the West, and in the early 1800s, they migrated in earnest into Spanish Florida. Blacks were also moving into the area at about the same time in order to escape slavery. As the Seminoles settled into Florida and developed their own towns and farms, they acquired a number of slaves, although it is not clear why. They may have done so as a way of imitating whites, among whom the owning of Black slaves appeared to be a symbol of power and influence. However, Seminole slavery was a relatively benign system in which the slaves tilled the land, kept a portion of the annual profit, if any, for themselves, and gave the balance to their Seminole landowner. The laxity with which the Indians treated their Blacks worried many slaveholders in Florida and Georgia, who insisted that their slaves were running away in order to join the Indian-owned slaves. The Black Seminoles, as they were sometimes called, lived in the same way as their Indian owners and allies. They dressed like them and hunted and fished as the Indians did. When Seminoles were removed from Florida between 1838 and 1843, nearly 500 persons of African descent accompanied them. Some of the Blacks had only recently joined the Seminoles through purchase, theft, or escape from nearby plantations. Several Black families, however, had lived among the Indians as slaves or free Blacks for 50 years or more as part of an alliance of Africans and Seminoles, which began about the time the Seminoles first became recognized as a tribe separate from the Creeks. In times of conflict with whites, such as when the government attempted to remove the Indians and return Blacks to slave plantations, the Blacks often cast their lot with the Indians. The Indians repaid them with their loyalty and respect. They also grew more dependent upon the Blacks as interpreters in their dealings with whites. There was some intermarriage between the two groups, but their primary bond was their mutual need to survive in the Florida wilderness against the ever-increasing threat of the United States Army. The impact of the conflict with the Army was experienced throughout the Florida Territory as ultimately full-scale war erupted. The important role of Blacks in this conflict generally has been not recognized. Florida's three Seminole Wars were essentially about Black people. The Seminoles simply refused to surrender to the slavers' chains, the Blacks upon whom they'd come to rely. Some of the Blacks who moved south with the Seminoles became distinguished leaders among the Indians and occasionally even led them into battle against military forces of the United States and on raids on white settlements. But their most indispensable function was language interpretation. The most noted among the Black interpreters was a former slave called Negro Abraham, who had escaped from Georgia and embarked on a new life with the Seminoles, marrying an Indian woman. He was characterized by the Army's commanding general in the field as, quote, "a Negro chief and the most cunning and intelligent Negro we have here," unquote. On March 28, 1833, with Abraham as their interpreter, the Seminoles signed what they thought was a preliminary set of conditions for their eventual removal to the West. They were embittered when the government informed them that they had in fact signed a binding treaty requiring them to vacate their lands immediately. The matter soured Abraham, who was accused by some of selling out the Indians. Maintaining his innocence, he never again lent his name in treaty negotiations. Blacks were present and participated when Seminoles massacred more than 100 white soldiers marching between Tampa and Ocala in the winter of 1834. Their commander was Brevet Major Francis Langhorne Dade, the man after whom Dade County is named. On December 28, 1834, a cold and rainy day, blacks joined forces with the Indians at the Great Wahoo Swamp. Together, they attacked Dade, who was marching with two companies and a 6-pound cannon from Fort Brooke, now called Tampa, to Fort King, near present-day Ocala. As the major tried to cheer the men on from horseback at the head of the column, his troops slushed their way along the little trail called the Fort King Road. Dozens of Indians suddenly rose from the palmetto bushes and from behind pine trees, firing at point-blank range. A bullet ripped through Dade's heart, killing him before he hit the ground. Half of his men, more than 50, fell at the first volley. Satisfied with their swift victory, the Seminoles withdrew. The battle might have ended then, except for an astonishing development. Instead of dispersing and taking cover in the pine woods, Dade's decimated forces chopped down small pine trees and hastily arranged them in a triangular fortification. The Indians, dumbfounded, watched from a distance as the soldiers boxed themselves in, presenting an opportunity that the chiefs could not ignore. In a final deadly assault, the Indians stormed the small fortification and overwhelmed the surviving soldiers. They left no one standing, then retired from the field. An expert on the Dade massacre gave this account of what happened next. Quote, "In a little while, the weapons had been gathered, and the Indians left the quiet enclosure, passing back through the woods towards the west, taking their three dead with them. Nearly 50 Negroes, runaway slaves, and Confederates of the Seminoles reined in and slid to the ground from saddleless horses. White eyes rolling in dark faces, they leaned on the barricade and saw for the first time white masters at their mercy. Escaped from brutal owners and stripped of everything but hate, they heard with pleasure the sounds of dying white men. Taking up the falling axes of the work crew and drawing the assorted knives they carried, they scrambled into the pen, cutting and hacking their way from man to man. Every throat that moaned was cut, and every heart that beat was stabbed. In the cold blue sky, the first vulture circled slowly." Unquote. The bodies remained unburied for more than 50 days. On the morning of February 20th, nearly 2 months after the battle, an army of 1,100 men reached the battleground. Quote, "Gracious God, what a sight," unquote, wrote Lieutenant James Duncan. Quote, "The vultures rose in clouds as the approach of the column drove them from their prey. The very breastwork was black with them. Some hovered over us as we looked upon the scene before us, whilst others settled upon the adjoining trees awaiting our departure," unquote. On the day of the battle, Major Dade had a black guide named Louis Fontier, also called Louis Pacheco. Dade used him to scout ahead of his troops. It had been asserted that Pacheco disclosed the troops' movements to the Seminoles, but this is almost certainly not true. The Indians had been watching Dade's column virtually since the time it left Tampa. The only route the troop could have taken was the Fort King Road. The Seminoles didn't need Pacheco to tell them that. For a time, it was assumed that the former slave and guide was buried with the rest of Dade's command, but the slave had survived the attack. In the early summer of 1837, he returned to Fort Brooke, the embarkation point of the Dade command. The first volley on that fateful morning had missed Pacheco, but with great presence of mind, he had dropped immediately to the ground and played dead. With Major Dade and the advance guard lying dead in front of him and the Seminoles approaching during the first attack, he had risen to his feet and pleaded for his life, explaining that he was a slave accompanying the command against his will. A Seminole chief named Jumper ordered his life spared, and Pacheco became Jumper's property thereafter. Chief Jumper accompanied Pacheco to his return to Fort Brooke, and the military authorities accepted his story. So, instead of being executed as a spy, Pacheco was sent west with a group of Seminoles to the Oklahoma Territory, where although technically he was still a slave, he lived on equal footing with the Indians. Later, he was sold again and taken to Austin, Texas, where he lived for 40 years. Presumably, he gained his freedom, though little is known of his life in Texas. The day at Masco was big news all over America. Nothing like it had ever happened. This Indian victory in the Florida Pine Woods would be surpassed in American history only by the slaughter of General George Armstrong Custer and his men at the Battle of the Little Bighorn in southeastern Montana several decades later. Following the day at Masco, General Thomas Sidney Jessup was charged with rounding up and removing all Seminoles and escaped slaves from Florida. He deployed an army of 8,000 men, the most formidable ever assembled in the territory up to that time. The debilitating effects of warfare waged by this overwhelming force marked the beginning of the decline of black influence among the Seminoles. Gradually, blacks surrendered, tiring of the unending conflict. Some told dreadful stories of the hardships involved in living closely with Indians under war conditions. The remaining Indians and a handful of blacks who stayed with them were forced further south on the peninsula towards the newly established Dade County. In the mid-1800s, a small band of Cuban Maroons, or Spanish Negroes, a mixture of Cuban, black, and Indian ancestry, already resided on the southern tip of the Florida Peninsula. This band, which may have included escaped slaves from the failed Farnell's expedition to Key Biscayne, remained neutral until August 7, 1840, when they participated in an attack on Indian Key. That attack resulted in the death of Dr. Henry Perrine, a well-known botanist who was the first man to plant mangoes in Florida and after whom a section of South Dade County was later named. Although the old ties between blacks and Seminoles may not be generally known by people in South Florida today, they're common knowledge among Seminoles. "We had a lot of blacks that spoke well the Creek language," my mother used to say, explained Mabel Jumper in an interview in 1990. Quote, "The colored people spoke the Indian language and they spoke English, so they could tell the Indians what the white people were doing," unquote, Jumper said. She noted that her great-grandfather owned and kept slaves in the typical Seminole way. Intermarriage between blacks and Seminoles was not encouraged, since Seminoles generally looked upon blacks as being inferior to themselves. Still, Indians interviewed for this work could describe Indian children within their various family groups today who are dark-skinned and have nappy hair as living testimony to the Seminole-Black alliance. The Seminole view of blacks is revealed in the following legend. As is apparent, the Indians viewed neither blacks nor whites as their equals. "The Master of Light said, 'We will make man.' Man was made, but when he stood up before the Master, he was white. The Great Spirit was sorry. He saw that the being he had made was pale and weak. He took pity on him, and therefore he did not unmake him, but let him live. He tried again, for he was determined to make a perfect man. But in his endeavor to avoid making another white man, he went into the opposite extreme, and when the second being rose up and stood before him, he was black. The Great Spirit liked the black man less than the white, and he shoved him aside to make room for another trial. Then it was that he made the red man, and the red man pleased him. In this way, the Great Spirit made the white, the black, and the red man when he put them on the earth. Here they were, but they were poor. They had no lodges, nor horses, nor tools to work with, nor traps, nor anything with which to hunt or kill game. All at once, these three men, looking up, saw three large boxes coming down from the sky. The Great Spirit said, 'White man, you are pale and weak, but I made you first, and I will give you the first choice. Go to the boxes, open them, and look in, and choose which one you will take for your portion.' The white man said, 'I will take this.' The box was filled with pens and ink and paper and compasses and such things. The Great Spirit spoke again and said, 'Black man, I made you next, but I do not like you. You may stand aside. The red man is my choice. He shall come forward and make the next choice.' The red man stepped boldly up and chose a box filled with tomahawks, knives, war clubs, traps, and other such things as are useful in war and hunting. The Great Spirit laughed when he saw how well his red son knew how to choose. Then he said to the Negro, 'You may have what is left. The third box is for you.' That box was filled with axes and hoes, with buckets to carry water in, and long whips for driving oxen, which meant the Negro must work for both the red and white man. And thus it has been ever since. Still, The blacks' only bondage was ignorance. Blacks, like men and women with no skill to offer only their hands, their brains could do nothing but manual labor. But being men and women, they learned. They put themselves under the protection of one chief or another and called him master, and to whom, for this consideration, they rendered a tribute of 1/3 of the produce of the land and 1/3 of the horses, cattle, and fowl they may raise. Otherwise, they are free to come and go at their pleasure, and in some cases are elevated to the position of equality with their masters, unquote. Folk tales and legends reflect the peoples and cultures from which they spring. It is apparent from this old Indian myth that racism is the domain of no single group.